Dark Wreath Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009, this is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 7. Lecture 11, delivered on September 22, 2009. The title of this lecture is Risk and Return.
Today, Risk and Return. This is actually not quite two lectures. It's more like one and a half lecture. But there's a large point here that has to do with one of the basic principles of finance. That the greater the risk, the greater the return. Now, before we go any further, I will stop and I will amend this statement by pointing out that that's not exactly true. That the greater the risk, the greater the expected return. Because we do not know the future. We cannot see the future. Now, the future is fairly close. If you're standing on a railroad track and there is a train barreling down you and it's about 20 feet away, we can pretty much predict what's going to happen. It's not going to be good for you. But if we take it a little further in the future, and we certainly cannot know the return. We can have an expectation of the return. It can be based upon our experience in the past, what we've read, what we think could happen. But it's not the actual thing. The actual thing will happen when it happens. We can formulate expectations about it. But here's the thing. We don't do things because we are stupid. Unless we, well, let me not get into things like Jackass movie or some of the stuff you see on YouTube. But even there, we do take risk because we expect something out of it. We don't do something for nothing. Even when we do something that is downright stupid, we do it for a reason. We have some motivation. It might just be personal satisfaction. It might be to impress our friends. It might be for money. But we have some expected return when we take a risk, you see. And that's the basic idea of what finance is all about. We take risks because we want something out of it. We expect something out of it. We anticipate that there is going to be a gain involved. But there are two kinds of risk. There's risk for which we will get a reward, or we should expect a reward, I should say. And then there's risk that we're not going to get a reward for it because we didn't have to take that risk. Two people could do the same thing. One of them could protect against risks that you can protect against. The other doesn't. I'm going to pay for only for the risk that you don't have to take on. If you take on extra risk that you could have avoided, that doesn't get you a reward. It's only for the risk that you could not avoid. So when I break down, the greater the risk. So when I break down risk, as I will later, I will distinguish between a risk that I call diversifiable, risk that I don't have to take, risk that I can get rid of, and non-diversifiable risk, risk that I can't get rid of. And that's the risk for which I will be rewarded. Now, finance, we have to start with what we are talking about when we talk about risk. risk is a diffuse measure. Certainly, if you jump off the top of one of the tall buildings here, the business building, if you jump off that, or if you plan to, you're taking a risk of cratering, breaking bones, possibly killing yourself, and hurting some of the nice squirrels who had nothing to do with this, your plan. That's a risk. But how do we quantify risk? Well, we like numbers that we can manipulate, work with, apply, and do analysis on. So we're going to have to put some numbers on risk. Now, there are a couple of different ways that we could talk about risk in terms of numbers. But one way would be to talk about volatility. If I were to look at a stock price through time, and I could see that some stocks actually move over in a very smooth pattern. Very low volatility. And then there are stocks, which I would look at through time, for which there would be ups and wild ups and downs. That would be a high volatility. That's a place to start. It's not the end-all, be-all. Volatility in and of itself is not good as a measure of risk. Certainly not of risk for which we deserve and some good return. Because that all that's telling us is that individual security whipsaws quite violently. But it might be the case that the part of that volatility that is non-diversifiable is pretty small. But it's a place to start. Volatility is. The width of the movements is sort of a thinking way, a way of thinking about the volatility. So let's go. What the hell is that? Is that your ass? Oh, that's your phone in your ass. Okay. Okay, good. I'll have to get that out of the podcast. Well, no, I'll leave it in. Let's talk here. Let's talk. Let's talk about states of the economy over the next year. State of the economy. And let us talk about the probability that that state is going to happen. And then from there, we will talk about the cash flow that would occur in that state. And looking at it at the end of next year. So we're going to talk about the state of the economy. And let's use some technical language here about the economy in through 2010. We'll talk, let's say, real bad, and then we'll say somewhat bad, and then we'll have one that's kind of in the middle. We could say, meh, sort of good, and then I was going to write, oh, God, but that's a little bit suggestive. Yeehaw. Just to give us some technical language for the economy. Now, if the economy is real bad, let's do the cash flow. Let me do the cash flows here. Cash flow real bad would be 20,000. The cash flow somewhat bad would be 30,000. Meh, that would be, we would have a $40,000 cash flow. Sort of good, 50,000. And then the yeehaw economy would be a $60,000 cash flow. Now, let's get down to some basics, and this is where I'm going to have you participate. First things first, we have to understand that it's a probability density function. It will have, the probabilities have to add up to one. There has to be we have to exhaust the space of possibilities. That's what it means to be a probability density function. I don't know, did they cover that concept, the probability density function, in stats for you? You're looking at me. Nope. Some of you are saying yeah, some of you are saying no. Well, it's sort of obvious. The states have to add up to one, a probability of one. You might be a guy, but you're definitely a guy or a girl. Okay. Okay, Jamie Lee Curtis aside. Okay. Old story. It's rumor. It's not true. That runner from Africa aside. You remember the one? Jesus. Anyway, you don't know that story either. What the hell? Why do I bother? You know, really? Okay. Let's work on it. Okay, let's add up. They add up to one. What's the probability of a real suckitude economy next year? Well, give it to me. What would you say? Just off the top of your head. Of a real sucky, you know, my God, this is bad. I'm going to go move to a hippie commune. The hell with trying to be a business major. You know, it's going to be ramen noodles for the next year. What's the probability of that happening? Talk to me. Just give it off the top of your head. Don't get something complicated. Just give me a 2-decimal probability, percent. 10%? Okay, we'll give it a 10.10. Now, somewhat, it's not like your life is going to end. You're not going to find an internship, but it's not going to be very good at all. It's going to be a bad economy, but it's not going to be horrible. What would you say probability of that is? 0.25. Okay, now, let's work from the top down. What about yeehaw, a really incredibly great economy? 0.10. How about a sort of good economy? 0.25. So what that would tell me is that we have 50, 60, 70. So you're saying a meh economy is 30%. So we got that all down. We got the distribution function down, states and their probabilities. Now, you don't have to have, you do not have to have symmetry. As a matter of fact, and we actually do this. I mean, it's not much more complicated when we do analyses of probabilities for cash flow, for profits, for revenues. We break it down. I mean, I've seen people break it down into 10 possible economic scenarios. Really, five is decent. It covers about what could happen. You get much more detailed than that. It just makes the calculations more complicated. You're really not accomplishing much. I usually do a very bad, sort of bad, meh, and then a decent and a really great. And it can be tilted one way or the other. If you're pessimistic about an economy, if you're bearish on the economy, you would have this skewed towards the bad side. If you're, you know, on really good meds, you might swing it the other way. So it would all depend. And you might believe that there is certainty. You're fairly certain of one state, but you're allowing for other states. That would concentrate the probability in one place or in a couple of places. If you had fair certainty, okay, we're going to have a good economy. How good? I don't know. You'd probably see these probabilities higher than the ones down here in the bad area. So you can shape it based upon your judgment. And there is there are resources online provided by economists who aren't too bad at their forecasting, especially the larger the pool. You will find that you can that these probabilities are out there. You can sort of source, so avoiding being attacked for your own subjective assessment, you can say, look, I referenced such and such a site where leading economists gave their assessments, or leading academics and business people gave their assessments of what the outlook, economic outlook for the next year is. This is very real stuff. We do this. We really do this kind of stuff, lay out these sort of states of the economy kind of thing. thing. So now we have to say, all right, what are we going to do with this? Well, we've got all these different values here. Well, what are they going to tell us? Well, it would be nice if we could have an expected number. If someone said, well, what do you think? Give me a number. Give me a number. Okay, fine. Get off me. I'll give you a number. How would we do that? Well, we would do it by the expected value formula. Now, in the book, you'll see them give this the Greek letter mu, or mu, if you're trying to be insulting to someone nearby. Mu is nothing but the sum over the probabilities from I equals 1 to n, where n is the number of states, here it's 5 in our example, of the probability of state I times the cash flow for state I, or whatever it is that you're actually putting there. Now that looks fancy. It's great to have a formula with sigmas and Greek letters of all kinds. You put that up on the refrigerator, people respect you. So that's why we do these fancy little formulas before we actually use the damn thing. Okay. So, and also this mu, you will see me actually write X bar sometimes, saying this is a statistic. It's not really the real number. There, out there somewhere in the heavens is a true mu. We're never going to see that. We have to use statistics, which estimates it. But for now, you'll hear me sometimes call this the expected value, not the average, not the mean. You'll hear me call it the expected cash flow. And the expected cash flow in this case would be, I would crank through, I would say, well, that's just the, all we're saying there is you take 0.10% times 20,000 plus 25%. Times of 30,000 plus 30% of 40,000 plus 25% of 50,000 plus 10% of 60,000 to get our expected value of this animal right here. Now I'm going to do this and hope to God someone is doing it with me so that I can, 1 times 20 plus 0.25 times 30 plus 0.3 times 40 plus 0.25 times 50 plus 0.1 times 60 equals, well, duh, of course it will. It'll come out to be 40,000. Yeah, of course, because it was a symmetric distribution. Okay. By the way, you're going to hear me use later in the course a term that's out there, but it's actually right here. We use the term weighted average. That's what that is. That's a weighted average. And we use those all the time. Where you'll see us use it again, definitely, is when we do weighted average cost of capital. We'll look at how much our debt costs us, how much our equity costs us, how much of each we have, and we take the weighted average. That's our weighted average cost of capital. So it's just the same thing we're doing here. It's just that there we won't be talking about probabilities. We'll just be talking about our debt to total assets ratio and our equity to total assets ratio. But it's the same thing. It's just a weighted average. Each of the components weighted by its contribution to the mix. So here we're saying, okay, $40,000. $40,000 is our expected cash flow for next year. But that does not mean we are going to hit $40,000. In fact, I'd be surprised. If we hit $40,000 next year, I'd like to talk to the analyst to see what he says about the horses at the racetrack. It will be, what we would like to do is, how sure are you? How sure are you that it's going to be $40,000? Well, I'd say, I have absolutely no confidence at all that it's going to be $40,000. Well, why did you tell me that? Well, that's a value, that's a number, a point. I can't have any confidence at all of hitting an exact number. I could be standing right in front of you and shoot you, aim right at your forehead. I have no expectation. For one thing, I suck as a marksman. I mean, I'll be lucky if you even get hit. But, you know, the probability of hitting exactly a single point, no. I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to say that. There's no probability that's going to happen. But I could give you a probability of a band that I'd be in. I could say, well, I'm about two-thirds sure that I'll be between two numbers. I'm about 95% sure that I'll be between these numbers as far as cash flow. Well, how would I do that? Well, that's the next thing. There's where we get to a metric for volatility, for spread, for what I call width. See, and this kind of comes from a mathematical geometric conceptualization of cash flow, which is sometimes useful. And you'll see me do this once in a while. I talk about the width of our expectations. Here, the range of our expectations is $40,000. See how $60,000 minus $20,000? There's a width there. But the width is more than just unidimensional. It's two-dimensional because there are probabilities in there, too, that create a second dimension. So I've almost got like an area here. So I'm talking about width in a more dimensional sense. So here's our second formula. Sigma, the standard deviation, which is the square root of the sum from I equals 1 to n of the probabilities of each event times each cash flow minus the expectation squared. Now, the reason we square it is so that positives and negatives from the cash flow, from the expected value, don't cancel each other out. And I'm sure you've probably heard that before. And the caution, of course, is just watch what you're doing, for God's sake. So in this case, the way I would calculate sigma is I take 0.1 times GER, 20,000, was it 20,000, minus the 40,000, plus 0.25 times 30,000, well, that's squared, 30,000 minus the 40,000, quantity squared, plus 0.30 times the 40,000 less the 40,000 quantity squared, plus the 0.25 times 50,000 less 40,000 quantity squared, plus the 0.10 times 60,000 minus 40,000 quantity squared. And then I'm going to take the square root of that whole mess after I've added those up. And so I would have, if I work this out, now correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm getting 21,213. For God's sake, someone tell me I'm right or wrong. Is that right? I hope that's right. 20,000. Let me do that one more time. 20,000 squared times 0.1, and then I'll times that by 2 because it's a symmetric distribution, plus 0.25 times 10,000 squared times 2 equals. No, it comes out, what do you get? Boy, this is way too much like work. Why am I doing this? I always like to do these on the fly like this, and then I'm sorry I do. 20,000 squared times 0.1 times 2 plus 10,000 squared times 0.25 times 2 equals. That's 130 million square root. Yeah, it comes out to be 11,401.75. $402. Did anyone else get that, for heaven's sakes? Yeah.
I got that.
You got that? Oh, thank God. It's confirmation. That's good enough. We may both be wrong, but we're wrong together. Now you say, well, there were dollars and cents there. Everything was in dollars, so any cents, putting cents on it, that's spurious accuracy. It's $11,402. Now, first thing is reality check. Does that make sense? It's in the ballpark of these numbers. If I had gotten something in the millions or something in the decimals or a negative, well, yeah, I would have maybe said, no, that can't possibly be right. So the fact that it came out to be a number in the ballpark of the numbers there, that gives me some confidence that, yeah, I've got it. I probably did it right, or close enough at least for government work. Now, what does it mean? Here you go. Here's your dinner. Look. The expected value came out to be $40,000. What this tells me is I can now say, well, what I would want to do is I would say, okay, find a place to write this. Oh, I can do it right here. Look, I'm going to take the expected value minus $11,402, and I'm going to take that expected value plus $11,402. Now, if I take $40,000 minus $11,400, $11,402, I get $28,598. And I get, on the top side, I get $51,402. So now let me draw a line here with a $40,000 in the middle of the line. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to write on each side of it these values. On the downside of it, I'm going to write that $28,598. Right there, $28,598. And then above it, I'm going to write the higher number, which was, what was that? $51,402. And I'm going to say, okay, well, what does that tell me? Ah, that's the cool part. Now, under a lot of circumstances, under a lot of conditions, I can say that I am 67% sure, certain, that the actual cash flow will land between $28,598 and $51,402. I'm about 67% sure. Now, where did I get 67%? Because that is the spread of 67% of a normal curve will lie one standard deviation on either side of the average of the expected value. In other words, if I were to see this as a bell curve, 67% of the area would be from the expected value plus one standard deviation down to the expected value minus one standard deviation. Now, does that have any use? Well, aside from the fact that now I can say that I'm 67% sure that I'll be in there. I can also say, well, what would happen? What if I wanted to be more certain? Well, I'd have to be vaguer. I have to have a bigger band to be more certain. Another hallmark place is the 95%. The 95% is two standard deviations. So instead of 11,402, I use 22,804 up and down. So I could do that. The hell did I put the, oh, there's a calculator. So I could do that, and I could say, all right, well, 40,000, 40,000 minus 2, minus 22,804, is 17,196. And 40,000 plus 22,804 is 62,804. So I could write these on that line too, these deeper values, which would be at 17,196 on the downside and 62,804 on the upside. And that one would tell me that I am 95% sure that I'm going to be in that band. Notice how I have to have less certainty about the width. The width has to be a lot wider for me to be more certain, to give that greater certainty. Now, what does that mean? Is there any meaning that would have in a business environment? The answer is, oh yeah. Yeah. Here's the deal. Suppose I am approached by someone in the management who says, we've got a plan for next year. And what we want to do is we want a worst case scenario for how much cash we're going to have. A worst case scenario. Well, I would say, well, worst case scenario, we all die and go to hell. And then he'd say, you're fired. And I'd say, wait, okay. What do you mean, worst case? How certain do you want to be? And he'd say, well, what do you mean by certain? I say, okay, would you like me to give you with 67% certainty, this is how bad it can get? Or would you prefer that I give you like 95% certainty that this is as bad as it's going to get? Now, they say, I see what you mean. I see. Well, I think we would be prudent in our fiduciary responsibilities if we took 95% certainty. We're 95% certain that we're going to see the worst it could get. I said, okay, well, if that's what you're looking for, our cash flow would be $17,192. I'm 95% sure that we're not going to get worse than that. And there you have essentially a tool for worst case scenario planning. Oh, I see. So in other words, you're saying that you're not about 95% sure that it's not going to be worse than our cash flow is not going to be worse than $17,196. Yes, that's right. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, go ahead.
Isn't that just an arbitrary number since we made up the percentages of what they could
do? Well, here's the deal. Actually, the answer to that is yes. But there's another point here, too. Now, assuming that these numbers were not created, and I'm glad you asked this, assuming that our numbers were not created while we were on crack cocaine, and assuming that our numbers were not brought to us from a trailer park in Decatur, and assuming that we didn't get our numbers by calling Paris Hilton, we have some knowledge that we did our best. And that's why you don't pull these numbers out of your ass. You actually think your way through the exercise. And also, that's the other part of it too, is covering your ass by going and getting professional economists, professional business people to give you their assessments of the probability. Now, are they going to be right? Uh-uh. They're going to be wrong. Sometimes they're so wrong, it's fun to make fun. I've actually been places upstairs over at COB, there was one professor talking to another professor, and the second professor was just standing there at the door. He has the dubious reputation of recommending Enron some years ago and recommending GM a few years ago. And so, you know, whenever we see him walking down the hall, unless he's on my tenure committee, and then yes, evil master, I'm not worthy to be hated by you. But other than that, we're wrong. But the point, though, is someone wants our answers. Someone wants us to tell them something. So we do our best. We go to what we think are good resources. We don't just guess. We actually put effort into it. And then we say, okay, fine. I'm wrong. Where were you going to go and get better? At the price, at the salary you pay. So don't say it like that. But and if you are in a company where there is a maturity, they understand. If you do your best, then yeah, you're going to be wrong more often than you're going to be right. And that's just the whole name of the game. We're trying to plan. And planning, actually, interestingly enough, this is something that I would talk about more in a management course. Whether you're right or wrong, planning has a life of its own that strengthens you when times get bad. And even if you're wrong, if you planned, okay, what happens if it got so bad that we were at $12,000 cash flow? We're still not in bad shape because we planned down to a very lean cash inflow. So the fact that we created a number, we geared ourselves around that, that in itself gives us a strength. We had a plan. We knew it could be bad. Yeah, we didn't know it could be this bad, but at least we were better prepared than the companies that just sat there and said, let the good times roll, and then suddenly it got ugly. So I'm glad you brought that up, though, because we can be wrong, but if we're wrong, we want to be wrong when we've tried to be right. That didn't actually make a whole lot of sense. What the hell? Anyway. And here's the other thing, too. I'm stating the probability stuff wrong. Really, in the reality, and if I were to teach you a hardcore probability theory course, not a stats course, a probability theory course, it's not that we're 95% certain that we're right. It's just that 95% of the time, the actual number will land somewhere in here. That's a different thing entirely than being 95% certain. But we use loose language in business because we're not math people. Let me take this off the board. We do this. We really do this. And you'll see me do some more of this maybe a little later in the course. And if you had me in a course in managerial science, you would see me do these kinds of calculations. These are actually awesome to do, not just for cash flow, but you can actually do these for things like cost. You can also do these for things like failure rates for products you're making, all kinds of different things you can do for assessing essentially where your boundaries are, what your worst case scenarios are, how you plan. In finance, however, and this is true in business in general, and also in your personal lives, our lives are not nuanced enough in any given situation to go through very deep calculations. Markets tend to be efficient. They tend to find a way to signal sometimes very complex information with just a single metric, a number that is widely used, widely understood, and at least to some extent, widely understood to have deeper implications behind it. But nevertheless, we can't go around looking at complex cash flow analysis with different state probability states and all of that kind of stuff whenever we want to assess risk. We can do that when we're at quiet time with our spreadsheets or with our pencil and paper. But out there in the world, the markets are going to want to flag risk with a number. Now, it might be a number that's blinking like a red light. It might be a number that we might have to tease out with a quick calculation or something like that. But we are going to expect risk to be signaled by a number. And here I went five times around the barn. I got to the outhouse. I found myself an expected value. I found myself a volatility number. That's good. That's fine. But that's not what a market's going to want. The market is going to want to at least sometimes signal, here's a number. And the number that will be, and the name that will convey risk in a market. Well, let me ask you, what is the thing that conveys risk in a market? What number conveys risk in a real place? You know, if you're looking looking at investments in a bank, looking at investments in the stock market, if you're looking at loans that you might take out, or if you're considering making a loan, there's one number that will flag your assessment of the risk, or someone's assessment of risk, or a market's assessment of risk. What is that number? What is it called?
Interest rate.
I love it when you talk like that. I'm going to start calling you Dennis. Yes. Okay, then. You're right. It's the interest rate. Look, on low if an interest rate is low, that's a low risk. If an interest rate is high, there's a high risk. If you want a loan from me, I charge out the ass. If Donald Trump wanted a loan from me, well, wait a minute. He drives every business he's ever run into the ground almost. And that's okay. He wears nice suits. Okay, credit card. High interest rate. What do you pay for a credit card? 16.9, stupid? Something like that? Yeah. High risk. A home loan. Lower risk. Why? Because the bank gets the house back if you can't pay it. And it's even better than that. You hear these banks that blubber about, well, we lost when we bought and took that, when we foreclosed on that home. Oh, horse shit. They have home insurance. It's called magic. And you, the home buyer, the borrower, were paying those insurance premiums. And then when the bank takes that house back from you, they get the home, the value of the home, and they get covered by magic. So there is very little risk in that loan. And don't let any bank blubber to you that there is a lot of risk in it. Where the hell was I? I feel that pain going up my left arm again. Think about this. A student loan. Those are fairly low interest. Why? Because the bank will be paid back if you go south. And then the government will chase your ass down for the rest of your natural life into your grave. Literally to your grave. And so that interest rate is actually flagging risk. It is like a one-stop metric for the risk of an investment. It is a one-stop number for the risk of a project. So when we start analyzing risk, which we will begin to hit on Thursday and then through in next week, when we're looking at the time value of money, well, we want to know what the risk of money in the future is so we can figure out how much that money is worth now. We use an interest rate to do it. That money's very risky, so maybe we'll use 15%. Well, no, I'm pretty sure I'll get that money in a couple of years, so we might use an interest rate of 6%. But the interest rate, all we're doing, and I'm trying to convince you that it's just a very common sense thing, when we figure out what money is from the future is worth right now, first we say, how risky is that money? Well, are we going to get it? Are we sure we are, or are we very unsure? Okay, once we know the risk of it, we just pop an interest rate on it. And that'll give us a way to bring it back. If it's very risky money that we think we will get in the future, it won't be worth much now. If it's fairly certain that we'll get in the future, it will be worth more now. That's all that's about. Now let me take you to this little thing here. And I'm going to write it right here. Oh. That really hurts the knuckles. So why did I keep doing it? I don't know. Because it kind of felt so good when I stopped. Okay. Look, suppose that I had two dead instruments. One of them is a one-year treasury bill. And the other is a 30-year Microsoft bond. And I don't know if Microsoft actually pays or has a bond out there or not like that, but this is like to taunt Bill Gates. Bill and I go back a long ways. He was a nerd who made a lot of filthy rich. I was a nerd who didn't. Whoops, I meant to put that yield up a little higher here. Okay, now, the yield on the T-bill right now might be about 0.17%. I think that's actually close to what it is now. Yes, that's actually a decimal percentage. That's sad. But the yield on a Microsoft bond is 6.25%. I want you to talk to me. These two are yielding substantially different interest rates. 1 year is barely positive right now. The 30-year, a lot higher. Okay, now, why is that 1 year T-bill giving a lower interest rate than the 30-year Microsoft?
1 year and the risk is low in 1 year over 30 years.
Okay, that's part of it. What do we call that? Come on. What is that? What premium was that? Do you remember? You had one back there? It's less risky. Okay, let's start with the first one. There's a low probability that Microsoft will default on a loan, right? Low. But it's not zero. It might very well be the case that at a news conference next week, Bill Gates is talking and all of a sudden he splits open and this ugly, slimy alien comes out and everyone sells Microsoft and the company goes into the ground as Bill Gates runs through the room eating everyone. I mean, it's possible. Don't tell me it's not. Well, you see, it's not likely that Microsoft is going to default on a debt. But it could happen. It is not, there's a difference between a zero probability, a perfect zero probability, and a tiny but positive probability. A government debt instrument will never go into default. The government will not default on a debt instrument. It will not. And there is a simple reason for that. If all else fails, if it can't tax somebody to pay off a bill, then it'll just simply print the money. The Federal Reserve will print the money to pay it off. That's how it works. That's what the Fed's doing right now, is it's printing money and it's going to the Treasury auctions to buy the debt that the government is borrowing. And what is the government borrowing for? Well, it's borrowing for a lot of economic stimulus, a lot of nice wars, but it's also borrowing to pay off old bills. Old debt instruments. It's refining, and the Federal Reserve is one of the entities that's coming to the auctions, and the Federal Reserve is buying debt instruments by printing money. The federal government will not default, so there is no default premium. No default premium. One source of risk is the default premium. The possibility that part or all of the cash flow will not be satisfied. So the default premium is not there. Now the other one, which several of you brought up, let me hold that off for a second. There is also, remember that expected inflation premium thing, the expected inflation premium? Well, with a longer instrument, you could have an inflation premium that was small for a little while. For a year, you wouldn't notice. Let's say you have inflation run at 3% for a year. That's barely noticeable. But over 30 years, that's a hell of a lot. You see what I mean? So there could be a compounding effect. Whenever there's any kind of an inflation expectation, you will see that cause yield curves to belch upward. They'll just boom like that. just because of the compounding effect of inflation, possibly, of expected inflation. But now let me get to the other one, the maturity premium. There is more chance for volatility, adverse volatility, over a 30-year span than there is over a one-year span. Suppose, for example, have you ever been on a roller coaster that would have been cool for 1 minute, but you're on there for way too long, and you're blowing chow, and you want to quit? I have been on those kinds. Dead relatives passing by me, is stars beginning to stream like they do in the Star Trek movies, and I can't even blow my groceries because they're stuck in my nose floating in the anti-gravity field. Yeah. Think about, okay, you and I are in a Land Rover, okay? And I put my goggles on. We're 30 feet from the Grand Canyon, sheer cliffs. At the bottom of those cliffs, there are skeletons and Land Rover rust pieces and vultures with their knives and forks, their little bibs waiting, and the moan of broken bodies still dangling from jagged rocks. And I give you a choice. I said, I can push the accelerator for 1 minute, or I can push the accelerator for 30 minutes. Which one is likely to cause to produce more risk to your ass? Probably the 30 minute.
Well, depends how close we are.
Well, let's say we're well back. You know, I said 30 feet. Let's say it's like about a mile back. Let's say it's a mile back. If I press it, yeah. I mean, if I press that thing for 30 minutes, you have a very high probability of meeting Jesus. Okay? Now, have any of you ever been in a haunted house? Okay, now, you see, here's the thing. Go into a haunted house, if I can open the door and I hear, "Go!" Well, that's cool, I'll leave. Fine, son of a bitch. But what if it's a Stephen King movie and I walk in and the door slams and I have to live there all night? There's a whole lot of chance that I'm going to be tossed around the walls, I'm going to get ectoplasm all over my body, and then I'm going to start speaking in ancient devil tongues when I come out, and all that kind of stuff, and then I'll be on Ghost Hunters International as a ghost, because I died. You see, this is the thing that I'm trying to convey to you. Understand that the longer you have to put up with something, the more risk there is that something is going to go wrong, you see. Go out on a date for 2 hours, live with the guy for 30 years. Oh, dude, you'll find out things you don't want to know about men. Trust me. Okay? You see, that's the risk thing. That's the risk thing. The longer you hold something, the more chance you're going to find out that that guy does not wash his underwear. Ever. What the hell did that have to do? Real finance for real people. Okay. I'm going to take this off the board here. But I want you to remember that one thing, that T-bill. Remember how I told you that at the heart of every interest rate is a core. We call that, in theory, we say risk-free rate. In practice, closest you could possibly want to come would be the return on a short-term T-bill. The annual yield on a short-term T-bill. But this risk-free rate sort of forms the base. Everything would have to pay at least that. If something didn't pay that, it would really weird me out. I can always get the risk-free rate by buying a treasury bill. So that would really, it would be almost unthinkable for something to pay a lower rate than a T-bill, because the T-bill is completely safe. So we would say that's like a base, like a rock bottom. Well, that doesn't help us assess how much we should get for other types of instruments, a stock the yield on a bond? What should the yield on a bond be? What should we get? What should be the yield on a the total yield, dividend yield plus capital gain on a stock? What would we be expecting? What would we expect? What kind of an interest rate should we use to discount future expected cash flows back to the present, which is what we'll do with the time value of money? What interest rate should we be using? How do we find that? Well, the first thing that we would have to do is say, all right, there is a rock bottom interest rate. We had better have that as the first thing we would ever look at. And then we have to ask ourselves, okay, we go to that idea of risk again, and the two kinds of risk. There's a risk that is no one's going to reward you for because it's stupid risk. There are stupid people who take that risk, and then there are smart people who don't take that risk. Why would a market, this senseless, gigantic will of the herd of billions of trades, trillions of dollars, why would it ever pay the stupid people for their stupid risk when they could pay only the part that was the smart people's choice? So we're going to have to take out, we're going to have to say, how could we possibly, what kind of an instrument, a security, a project would show us a yield that was purely non-diversifiable risk? There is actually an instrument. It's a theoretical instrument, but we can approximate it very closely without going to the nightmare. Suppose that I invested in everything, every stock in the economy, and my weights of each investment would be in proportion to that company's contribution to the economy. You contribute 5% to the economy. The size of your company is 5%. So 5% of my portfolio would be your stock. You contribute a thousandth of a percent to the economy. So a thousandth of a percent of my investment would be yours. All through the economy, I would create this kind of theoretical thing. If I covered every stock in the economy and put it in its weight according to how much it contributed to the economy, that would actually remove all of the stupid risk, because you've got the whole economy in there. Now, there might be a few stupids in there, but they would be washed out in such a huge, highly diversified portfolio. So we would say to ourselves, well, let's talk about the theoretical return to that portfolio. We would call that R sub M, the return to the expected return to the market portfolio. The expected return to the market portfolio. Now, obviously, no one can do that. But we may have time this semester. I can show you that by the time you get up to 100 stocks, 100 of the biggest stocks of the economy, and weight each one of them in your portfolio by its contribution to the whole portfolio, your yield is going to be right about R sub M. It's going to be about that. And that's why you buy into these buying stocks, individual stocks. Oh, that's stupid as hell. Really? Unless you have some kind of insider information, and if you do, the SEC is going to catch you. You buy a mutual fund. That's what they do, is they diversify. They buy up all of those different stocks, put them in their right weights, and they maintain them in their right weights because companies grow relative to each other, so they keep it balanced. You buy into these mutual funds and buy into a really wide one, there you go. Okay, so now, we have the theory of it, and we even have a means by which we could look at market data and get R sub m, or at least a good approximation of it. We can get an approximation of R sub f looking at a t-bell. We can get a reasonable approximation of R sub m looking at some of these very well-diversified market portfolios out there of mutual funds. As a matter of fact, S&P 500, if you look at a portfolio of just the S&P 500, that's a darn good one. Dow isn't too bad. It's a little bit heavy on, I mean, it's got just 30 in it, but even there, you're in the right ballpark for R sub M. So, okay, we've got the theory of R sub M and R sub F, and we even have ways that we could get real-world data to actually use these. So here's what we're going to do. Look at this thing, R sub M minus R sub F. We call that the market premium. It's how much you are rewarded above risk-free for bearing the risk of the market portfolio. It's your premium for having, let me think of a better way to say this. It's your premium, it's your reward for being butch. You see, you can always invest in a T-bill, no risk, okay? So there's no glory. Or you can invest in the market portfolio, risk and glory. So what we are looking at when we do that R sub M minus R sub F, we're saying, how much of a reward do you get for glory? Look, suppose that the market portfolio right now is, we're expecting it to return about 14%. And suppose that we're expecting the risk-free rate right now to be about 1%. Then R sub M minus R sub F would be 13%. This is the premium you get for taking risk. That's your premium. That's your reward for taking risk. Right there. Because that's how much extra you get for deciding that you want to be burly for the day. That's your extra. Your reward for market risk, for bearing the risk of a market portfolio instead of just wimping out and taking a treasury. Now here's the upshot. Here's the upshot. Again, I'm returning to numbers that, yeah, we're talking theory here, but we're also talking stuff we use and that we can get our hands on. And here's the last of those, and it takes us back to the beginning of this exciting lecture. Remember what I was talking about, that standard deviation, that sigma thing? Really? Yeah, we use it sometimes, and there are places where we'll use it. And I'm going to obviously ask you something about it on a quiz or something like that, or on a homework, take-home quiz. But that's not the one we use. That's really the hot one. It would be great if we had a measure of risk that used sigma, but put it in terms of what it means to our reward. See, when I did that sigma, that was just telling me volatility. It was a measure of volatility. It didn't tell me anything about reward or relative reward. It would be very extremely cool if we had a number that was talking more about the reward in terms of investments. Now, surely the interest rate does that, but that's not going to help us when we are actually trying to think about how to get an interest rate for a project so that we can discount cash flows and all that. We have a trick. You'll see this more when we get to what's called the capital asset pricing model. But I want to show it to you now. It's based on sigma. You would use sort of the formula like sigma. It's called beta. Now the beta of a stock is the factor by which that stock's return is different from the market premium. Remember what the market premium is. Premium is. It's that R sub m minus R sub m. Okay? So what this beta, this very cool thing, and it's not that hard to calculate. We'll do some, but I'll tell you what something here in a second about this. But what the beta does, it's essentially, it's a magnifier. It tells us. So for example, if someone said, well, the beta of this stock is 1.20, I would immediately know that we expect that stock to pay 120% of the market premium. It's premium. The premium for this stock is 120% of the market portfolio premium. So if you told me that the market portfolio premium is 13%, and you told me that this the beta of this stock was 1.20, I would know that the premium for this stock, not the whole return, but the premium for this stock would be 1.2 times 13%. Or I should expect about a 15.6% premium over risk-free if I do this stock. Now, work with me here. So if I said the beta of a stock is 0.50, I'd say that its premium is 50% of the market portfolio's premium over risk-free. If I told you, okay, let me try this. What would be the beta of a T-bill? What would be the beta of a T-bill? Zero. It has no risk. It has no beta. It has a beta of zero. Because essentially, you will get no reward, no premium for this. You'll get no premium. You don't want to take risk? Zero. What would be the beta of a perfect market portfolio? Of a perfect market portfolio. The whole nine yards of the economy. What would be that beta? This one's a little harder. It'd be 1.00. The market premium is 100% of the market premium. And you say, oh, well, duh. Okay. And so essentially, in a way, you can actually now have a metric. Now, here's something interesting. There are actually a couple of things you can invest in that have negative betas. Some gold mining stocks actually have negative betas. Weird as it may sound, they actually have negative, they move negatively with the market. They're like, we call them reversals, reverse funds. You can invest in these mutual funds that actually have betas that are slightly negative. They actually move against the market. So if you're a contrarian and everyone's saying, oh, the market's going to rise, you would go to something that has a negative beta to try to beat the market. So, but now here's the bottom line. Here's the bottom line of this. The beta of the stock, how used is beta? I want you to go, if you have any time at all, finance.google.com, as good as any place. Just type in a company that's a public company, and the financial information will splay out. AOL, MSFT, IBM, I don't care what you do. Just put it in there, and watch the financial information splay out. Right at the top, one of the first numbers they're going to tell you, one of the numbers in this little panel right there at the top is the beta. You go to Yahoo Finance, you go to Standard & Poor's Reports, anywhere you go, beta is there. Now you know what it means. So if you are risk averse, you'd probably stay with betas that were under one. If you want to take some butch risk, you'd go with betas over one. If you were really crazy, maybe betas over two. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.